From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Just in time for summer's reading list and the fall's election cycle is a book about how popular culture, so movies, books, and TV shows, relate to political theory. UW La Crosse Assistant Professor of Political Science Tim Dale helped edit the book and wrote a chapter on The Simpsons, which is where the book, Homer Simpson Ponders Politics, takes its name. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis asked Dale why it's important to examine the politics behind pop culture.
Well, not everyone thinks pop culture is important, and actually my chapter in the Homer Simpson Marches on Washington, I have the first chapter in that book, and it's directed at the people who argue that pop culture shouldn't matter or it's a distraction. And the common thought is that popular culture distracts people from politics or moves people away from being politically active. They just turn on the TV and they stop paying attention to politics. But I don't think that that's true. In fact, I think that a lot of what we know about politics and understand about politics comes directly from popular culture. So one of the arguments that I use frequently to talk about this is that our images of presidential candidates come largely from Saturday Night Live characters of those candidates more than they do the candidates themselves. So our memory of George W. Bush or the first Bush or Bill Clinton or candidates like Al Gore, even John McCain and Barack Obama, during those campaigns, Saturday Night Live, an entertainment show, is framing the way that people understand the candidates. And by exaggerating mannerisms and tendencies, we actually kind of impressed on our cultural memory what those candidates were like. And I think that's a very obvious example of the way that popular culture can affect what people are doing in politics. So I think that's one of the ways that popular culture is important. The Homer Simpson Ponders Politics book gets a little bit more in depth. And in this book, we're talking about the philosophy behind certain texts in popular culture and how that is reflective of a politics. So, for example, there's a chapter in the book titled From John Wayne to John McClane, the Conservative Action Hero. And that chapter does a very nice job of showing the way in which cowboy movies and action hero movies have a politics to them. In those movies, in those plays or novels, the hero is required because the country has failed. The state has failed. The state is unable to protect people ultimately. And so the hero has to declare kind of a state of emergency in which the hero can operate as a hero. And that's actually reflective of the kind of politics we saw during the Bush administration, the war on terrorism, this argument that the state and its liberal protections don't always function to protect people from their greatest threats.
Does all good or successful pop culture contain some sort of a reference to political theory or political philosophy?
Not necessarily. I think there's probably quite a bit of popular culture out there. I'm thinking one of the things we've had a hard time finding a political connection to is reality television. That's very popular, but it's not necessarily kind of intentional in its politics. The question really isn't, is all popular culture doing that? But in what instances do we find it as particularly good examples of popular culture doing this? One of the sources for a lot of people's information that's in popular culture that is kind of blurring the lines between popular culture and media is shows like The Daily Show, where you have Jon Stewart delivering a fake news show, and yet it is directed not only at real information. People are more informed to watch The Daily Show than many other cable news outlets, but also providing some both satirical look but serious look at criticizing media, but also political candidates and representatives. So I think that's another example where people turn something on for entertainment, but they're getting more than entertainment, and it's contributing to a national dialogue about really important issues, even if it's done in a way that people find very entertaining.
You happen to write the chapter on The Simpsons in the book. You're probably a big fan of The Simpsons. Why do you think The Simpsons are a good pop culture vehicle to explain political theory?
Right. And in the case of The Simpsons, we have a lot of things going for it. One of them is I enjoyed watching The Simpsons for a very long time. That's just my personal reflection on it. But one of the things that The Simpsons has going for it most broadly is that it is the longest running show on television. By leaps and bounds, more seasons of The Simpsons, more episodes of The Simpsons than any other, certainly animated show, any other half hour show. And in that time, The Simpsons started with some fairly crude humor, you know, Bart Simpson's the rebel and Homer's the disengaged father. Marge is a worrier. Lisa's the nerd. In the course of all of those episodes and as the seasons went on, The Simpsons started tackling really important issues of family and religion and politics. And so my chapter is looking at some of the ways in which The Simpsons reflects some classical themes in political philosophy. And one of them is the importance of the personality of the city, the community of people. One of my arguments in the chapter is that The Simpsons is about more than just the family, The Simpsons. It's about the town of Springfield. And as episodes have been created over the years, we see the town of Springfield containing several different elements, many different people who struggle with the learning that goes on as a part of a community. And it turns out in The Simpsons, the community is a really important place where people learn how to be good citizens. And so there are several episodes and examples where Lisa, the one who supposedly knows it all, has to learn something from other members of her community who she might have initially disrespected, but learned that members of the community all have something to contribute. So that's an example where The Simpsons is really rich with a lot of different philosophical and political messages.
The philosophy of Aristotle you touch on quite a bit in the chapter.
Right. My argument for those who are fans of philosophy is that The Simpsons is Aristotelian. It reflects Aristotle's politics. And this may be surprising. People think of Aristotle as a fairly conservative political philosopher. Of course, ancient Greece, so we're dating back 2,000 years. But one of the things that Aristotle emphasized was the importance of community for sustaining a society and how each member of a community plays a particular role. And one of the things we see in The Simpsons is that each member of the city of Springfield serves a certain function. And when they go outside of that function, that typically leads to the disorder of an episode. So there's an episode where it turns out that the principal's a fraud and Skinner is actually an imposter. And the town goes out of order because the principal's actually not the principal. And by the time the episode ends and we get all the humor and disorder that happens because of the plot developments, at the very end, the judge who is sentencing the actual principal Skinner to leave town because they don't want the real one, they want the imposter back. The judge also declares that no one will ever speak of this again. In that episode, we see that this community has to go back to normal at the end of every episode in order to have the next episode start again. And so that move from disorder back to order is reflective of some things we see in Aristotle.
I don't know if you know any of the producers or writers on the show or have had a chance to talk to them. But do you think they think about stuff like this when they're actually producing an episode of The Simpsons?
I think that they sometimes do. When people are writing shows like The Simpsons or really anything where they're trying to entertain people, they want to tap into some things that are meaningful. So it's not just about making people laugh. It's also about making people think. And if you can make people laugh and think at the same time, you're really doing something. I actually think back to All in the Family and Norman Lear, who is making the show All in the Family to be the hit show that is the highest rated show on television. But Lear says, I am making this show also to make people think. And so I think one of the points of this collection and our work in popular culture and politics is we're arguing that people don't have to make a choice. You don't have to make a choice between putting something into it. This is for entertainment category or this is for teaching people about politics category. In fact, for as long as people have been writing down words and telling each other stories, they've been doing both. So if we look at Shakespeare, Shakespeare is doing politics and entertaining people. Some people forget, certainly not Shakespeare scholars, that when Shakespeare wrote his plays, he was writing them for a general audience. He wanted sellout performances. He wanted people to laugh at them. He wanted people to get angry. He wanted people to be moved. But he was also writing them with some political purposes embedded in them, which is why they've stood the test of time. Our argument is that there are many things that are part of our cultural conversation today that are doing the exact same thing.
How would you describe the mayor of Springfield and how he relates to current modern-day politicians?
Well, Mayor Quimby is the archetype of the corrupt politician who has his hands in many different pies. In fact, there's one time in which the Mensa members in an episode, the geniuses of the town, go up to call him on a particular code violation in the gazebos in the town park. And Quimby thinks he's being called out for his corruption. And so he actually jumps out the window with his escape plan and leaves the town, leaving the town to the geniuses to run for an episode. In many episodes, we see political figures not being portrayed in a very good light. And so the commentary on The Simpsons is a common commentary we see in a lot of popular culture, which is very negative toward politics. But even in that negativity, there are moments for redemption. So at the end of the episode, they call Quimby back. It turns out the geniuses aren't as genius as everyone thought. The town goes into disarray. It's actually Stephen Hawking who comes in and saves the town. But that is a good example where on the surface you see Mayor Quimby as the corrupt politician. But then when you get deeper into it, the town realizes that they need political leaders. And Quimby may, after all, be the best one that's available to them.
Entertainment and animation aside, Springfield is really representative of a common American city, isn't it?
Well, and that's why
wouldn't you say that?
Absolutely. And that's why the writers didn't want to identify it. Springfield is supposed to be all of our town. We're not supposed to see it as a place that's out somewhere else. We're not supposed to see it as this town is unlike any other I've seen. The town looks a lot like the towns that we live in. Now, granted, we don't have the same characters in our town, but we see that the town has the common components to all communities, and that's another way in which it reflects the philosophy of Aristotle, as I describe it in the book chapter.
So if Springfield is a common town with a common electorate, I assume, what does that say about the electorate of this country?
Well, again, I think The Simpsons presents a fairly complex picture. So there are many episodes in which the people are easily persuaded. A monorail salesman comes into town one day and with a brief, catchy monorail song convinces everyone they need to build a monorail, which is, of course, going to be a disaster. Barney is one of the monorail drivers. In one case, and this is actually reflective of many animated shows, take the position that the electorate of democracy isn't always the most useful place to make decisions or most productive place to make decisions. We see some of the same things going on in the South Park show and getting a lot of mileage out of a democracy being a bad place. The sophisticated view, though, and a little bit deeper, is that it turns out that this is still the best way to run a community. So even though you have these big disasters that happen because you can't always trust democracy, the community comes together and saves itself at the end. So even though the episode begins, in the case of the monorail, with the electorate being one that's easily persuadable and not particularly wise, the electorate, the community, comes back together at the end and still manages to save the town. And so I think that's the view of democracy that's more sophisticated. It's cynical, but it also ultimately believes that there is a good society that's to be had within a democracy.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio La Crosse. I'm John Davis. We are talking with UW La Crosse Assistant Political Science Professor Tim Dale. He's a co-author and co-editor of the book Homer Simpson Ponders Politics, Popular Culture as Political Theory. Aside from The Simpsons, what are some of your favorite pop cultural references and how they relate to politics examples in this book?
The conservative chapter is really interesting to me. And I think to think about things that we see as very typical forms of American popular culture, like the Western or the action hero, and how that's reflective of political philosophy, I think that's really interesting. I also think that the chapter on The Lord of the Rings is interesting, and that also is reflective of what we're talking about with the Aristotle in The Simpsons. In The Lord of the Rings, we see the friendship between the characters developing, and that's also a very good chapter. The last chapter of the book may be one that is less about a popular culture text and more about our culture in general, and that's the one written by my co-editor, Joseph Foy. Broadly speaking, our culture has become hyper-mediated. Everyone is a reporter now. Everyone is on Twitter. Everyone is on Facebook. And what Dr. Foy talks about in that chapter and what explores is how this in some way is fulfilling the promise of liberal democracy. That is, we all are a participant in our society. But there's a criticism out there that's being made by good sound reasoning and scholarship that says that the internet actually causes us to remove ourselves from politics, and what counts as political participation becomes less and less. And I think this is a really interesting question. As people become more in control of the messages that they receive, popular culture does not become as it becomes less monolithic than it's been. So it's not, we aren't just getting one message all the time from one or two media outlets. We're going out and choosing. And so the questions proposed in that chapter have actually led to some of the questions that I'm asking now in terms of what the nature of popular culture is and is going to be in the 21st century, and how it is that people are taking a more active role in the culture that they're consuming and what that's doing to our overall conversation in a democracy.
What is it doing?
Well, that's the question I'm asking right now in the work that I'm doing. I think we're seeing several negative aspects of it. One of them is that people tend to choose people that they agree with to talk to. And one of the cornerstones of democracy, and this is rooted in the political philosophy that's argued for democracy from a long time, we see some of the best arguments in James Madison's contribution to the Federalist Papers about the importance of a diverse and pluralistic society for a democracy. Also, John Stuart Mill's Marketplace of Ideas. One of the things that is a negative impact on those ideals is when people don't talk to people who are different from them any longer, and you're not having a cultural discourse that is working through differences. You're having these little echo chambers that are developing where people only talk to people who are like them, and that actually increases conflict in society. We no longer have to resolve conflict. We can have our own little ideas, and then we have bigger and bigger conflicts when it comes to our public debates because we've been so insulated. That's a negative element. But there are also positive elements. More people are informed today than have ever been, and more people are connected to political arguments. One of the things we've seen is a proliferation of interest groups. So if you have a passion, if you have a concern about something, it only takes you a few mouse clicks before you find other people who have like-minded things. I think that's good for democracy. People have more outlets for expressing themselves, and people are empowered more than they've been ever before. So an average citizen can go on Twitter and change our cultural conversation if they say the right thing and it gets picked up by the right person. That's the kind of thing that I think is a promise of that kind of democracy over the internet. But there are also those pitfalls. And so that's, I think, kind of the future of thinking about popular culture and democracy is to think about these kinds of cultural developments.
Back to that negative aspect of people talking with like-minded people, is there anything from history that shows where we may be headed with that?
One of the positives of this is that we really haven't had a time in history before where everyday people have been empowered to the level that they've been. So where we've seen this kind of be as negative examples in history is when you have an aristocratic class or a ruling class that doesn't have to listen to people. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, then that's where, you know, tyranny comes from. And so we haven't had a time in history where everyday people have had as much power as they've had. And it really is unprecedented then that those people can get together with people who are exactly like them and not talk to anybody else. So we have seen some examples in history where people who are in charge haven't listened to people who are out of power. Mm. But it really is unprecedented, I think, raising really interesting questions about where American democracy could go potentially as a positive thing or could go negatively is when people are empowered, what do they do with that power?
I knew you made a reference before about the fact that there are some people who dismiss popular culture in society, but I think the vast majority are consumers of it. They read books, they watch movies or TV. Do most people view popular culture when they're viewing it for entertainment value, or do they look at the politics behind it? And I assume that's what this book is designed to make people think about, but
right. Well, definitely people view it much more for entertainment purposes. And in fact, I really doubt that anyone other than maybe the contributors to my book turn on the TV to consume political messages in things that they enjoy. But I think that part of the reasoning behind this work that we're doing and the writers of these chapters and this collection are intending is for people to think a little bit more about the political messages in the popular culture that they're consuming. So when we turn on 24, which is now back on television, and it's about the war on terror. It's about how you go after criminals. It's about how you persecute a war. And there are messages in 24 about either validating or being contrary to foreign policy opinions and strategies that we have debates about. And so those the people who make shows like 24 are intending to contribute to the cultural conversation even as they are making popular culture. Another example that people might be even more familiar with is the Star Wars episodes 1, 2, and 3 that Lucas went back to and made starting about a decade ago. And in these films, Lucas is making them during the Bush administration. And there are some key moments where I would imagine many viewers couldn't help but see the political messages in them. So there is a scene where the emperor is elected emperor and the entire Senate is applauding. And Queen Amidala says, "This is how freedom dies," with a round of applause. And this is Lucas having a message within Star Wars, which is, you know, consumed. People don't go to Star Wars to get a political message. But this is a really good example of where when people are consuming something for entertainment value, it's also helpful to see how it is that the person who produced this is communicating political messages.
I know a lot of people, or some people, we just talked about this, I think pop culture has been a detriment, especially since the beginning of the 60s. Does that argument relate to the book at all, that pop culture has somehow denigrated society or led to its decline?
It might. And actually, I think debates about that culture wars argument actually happens in popular culture. So there are arguments in popular culture that are responding to that debate. And so it's not really popular culture. The messages in popular culture aren't necessarily conservative or liberal. We're getting a whole range of messages. And one of the things that I think we find is that popular culture tends to be more libertarian. That is, it is open to a free – wants a free exchange of ideas, tends to be permissive. And so I think there are certainly some who think that popular culture is bad because it promotes a kind of permissive society. There's actually several people who are on the political left, leftist intellectuals, who also criticize popular culture with the argument that it allows people to escape from their political responsibility, that it is an irresponsible form of politics because democracy requires activism. So these people want political activism and don't find political activism on the internet, don't find political activism in popular culture. There are some who criticize, for example, U2 having a concert to promote awareness of the plight of people in Africa, that criticism is that is an irresponsible use because it allows people to go to a concert and then feel like they did something for their society. So there is a whole range of criticism of popular culture that popular culture or people who are critics of popular culture either have to respond to or find agreement with. And these are the kinds of things we talk about in the book.
Tim, who is this book intended for?
The book is intended for anyone who is interested in questions of popular culture, who may want to know a little bit more about the politics within that popular culture. So people who are looking to learn a little bit more about political philosophy will find something in this book that will teach them about political philosophy, but primarily will help people think about how it is that the popular culture texts that they're watching all the time or reading about or listening to in the form of music, how that in a deep and maybe subconscious way informs people's political thinking about things that are happening in society.
Tim Dale is an assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse and co-author and co-editor of the book Homer Simpson Ponders Politics, which looks at the relationship between political theory and pop culture. He was interviewed by Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site also has archives of other recent editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.